Good morning and welcome to another episode of Inside UMiami Medicine. Today, I am fortunate to welcome to the studio Dr. Mikhail Sekeres, professor of medicine and a world-renowned leukemia specialist who happens to be the chief of the Division of Hematology and Oncology at the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Miami Leonard M. Miller School of Medicine. Dr. Sekeres, welcome, and thank you so much for agreeing to speak to us this morning.
Thank you for having me. What a pleasure and a privilege it is to be here.
Great. For the audience, please tell us a little bit about your journey to your current position in terms of where you grew up and what got you interested in medicine and oncology altogether, and why you ended up here at the University of Miami.
Sure. It's always hard to know where to start with that question, because we all get it sometimes. I was born and bred in Providence, Rhode Island, the biggest little state in the union, and I come from a family of English majors. So I don't know if it was a beneficial or deleterious mutation to be focused on science and medicine.
You went rogue.
And I went to college at Penn at the University of Pennsylvania and stayed there for medical school, and also got a master's of science in clinical epidemiology while I was there. And then went to Boston for my training. So I was at Mass General for internal medicine residency and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute for my hematology oncology fellowship. And then went straight from fellowship to Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, where I was for 18 years before coming down here. And, you know, there are so many reasons I wanted to come here. This is such an incredibly vibrant and culturally diverse place, and that's something that I missed when I was in Cleveland. And the university is growing at such a rapid pace and attracting such incredible luminaries, and I really wanted to be part of that.
Wonderful. Well, let me backtrack a little bit. Here are you, and growing up in a family of English majors. How do you develop a love for science, and why did you decide to go into internal medicine and choose oncology?
I've always thought that medicine is inherently about storytelling. So if you think about it, a patient comes to us and they tell their story of illness, and then we reframe that story in our own minds to try to make sense of it, and so to see if it fits into a logical pattern or if it doesn't. If it does fit into a logical pattern, we often can come up with a diagnosis and then a treatment plan, and there's a story of treatment. If it doesn't fit into that logical progression of events, then we tell the story to our colleagues when we consult them. And hopefully they can make sense of that story, or maybe there are two stories that are developing. So I've always felt like the better we are at storytelling, the better doctors we are, and the better we can ask questions of our patients about their story. My dad was a journalist. He was a reporter for the Providence Journal Bulletin in Rhode Island, and then he was an editor. And I remember when I was in high school, I'd go out to parties, right, like we all did, and then you'd come slinking home and not want to divulge any information about what actually transpired over the past few hours.
No storytelling, yeah.
And my dad, the reporter, I'd come in and he would say to me, well, you know, what was the house like? When you walked through the door, where was the living room? Where was the kitchen? What kind of food did they serve? Where did they have the food set up? And he'd ask question after question so he could picture the scene as if he were there. And I realized after starting on my medical journey that that's really what we do with patients. We're trying to be good reporters, good journalists, and elicit those facts that eventually will tell a clear story of their illness.
So I can imagine Thanksgiving dinner in the Sekeres family. So it's a competition of storytelling from the reporter side and the physician side and all the other English majors.
It was, and in fact, we took it to next level, and I don't know if this is a great story to tell or an incredibly embarrassing story to tell, but it became our family tradition that my brother and I would write a play every Thanksgiving, and everyone would have to act in a play. And that's actually where we revealed all the family secrets from the year. So there were no secrets whatsoever. And everyone had to participate as an actor in the play.
That's fascinating. Of course, I had no idea about the Thanksgiving tradition, but I just can only imagine just from hearing you talk about the family dynamics. So that's wonderful. So that clearly, this not only the storytelling from the perspective of the patient, but also your background in growing up in the family of writers and reporters influence some of your decision making, and now you've become a contributor for the New York Times, and you, in your own ways, talk about the experiences that you have taking care of cancer patients. Tell us a little bit about that and what motivated you to even engage in that particular aspect.
Well, Dean Ford, we all go through this, I think, during our training, and then when we start our professional careers, we meet people from all walks of life with all different types of stories. And it's really, people have said before, it's a privilege to be a doctor or a nurse and to have this contact with patients. And as a hematologist oncologist, I always say I'm an unwelcome guest in my patient's home. They don't want to invite me into their story. They don't want to have a story of cancer. So I feel as if it's my job to honor their story and their journey, and to recognize really the heroism of our patients as they go on this unwanted journey and as we're included with them as they go through their illness. So I have always been a writer, and I suspect that I approach medicine with a liberal arts brain and not as much of a science brain. I wonder if I tell the story of science in a different way than people I would consider to have scientist brains. But what I've tried to do with storytelling is really honor my patients' stories and also understand their perspective. And I think we're taught this. I think a good doctor and a good nurse learns this, that when you go into a patient's room, and that might be your own clinic room or a hospital room, and you have an interaction with them, and you leave that interaction and something in your stomach twists, something didn't feel right about that interaction. I think if we're good, responsible healthcare providers, we take a moment to say, okay, what happened? What didn't feel right about that? We try to explore what our patients brought into that interaction, but also what we did, and try to get to that nugget of truth. I think that good narratives in medicine, if you're writing, And I teach this when I have seminars with trainees or junior physicians about writing. A good story always starts in the middle, right? And that's what we're doing. We're walking into the middle of our patient stories, and then it works a little bit backwards and then a little bit forwards and comes to some sort of resolution. So when I come out of a patient's room and I get that twist in my stomach, I think to myself, I've got to explore this. And sometimes in exploring it, that in itself creates a story.
Clearly, the humanism comes out, not just from our conversation here, but certainly from the stories that you write. Yet, in so many ways, when we go through training, it seems to be, I mean, studying with residency, but most of our medical students, if I even digress more, come in with full of hope, full of compassion, full of empathy, and they want to change the world. But yet, as you go through the training process, invariably, there is a dehumanization that takes place. People become almost insensitive, but yet you've managed to capture all of the humanism, and then you narrate the story of those patients from a perspective of a very caring physician. What motivated you to get there, and why do you think it's important for us to maintain that component of our training and our, and how does that impact our ability to provide care more effectively?
Yeah, it's a really insightful perspective, Dean Ford, on this, because I do think that we come into medicine for all the right reasons, right? It's almost trite to say we go into medicine because we want to help people. Of course we want to help people, right? Sometimes we're motivated to go into medicine because we've seen something that's happened with one of our own family members. I myself have had a multitude of family members who've had cancer. I've had family members who have leukemia as well. So I've seen their journey from a different perspective as well, that of a family member and sometimes caregiver. And there is something about training that takes us out of that initial motivation. And, you know, I once wrote a piece with a friend of mine named Tim Gilligan, who actually is a communications expert. He goes around the country teaching doctors how to talk to patients. And in this piece, we wrote about how we take communications courses in medical school, and they may have an unintended consequence. And that is that they actually may teach students that they need to talk differently to patients than how they did before they entered medical school. I personally think an ideal way to talk to a patient is the way I would talk to one of my own parents. You're sitting around a kitchen table having coffee, talking about someone's illness. You know, you don't use highfalutin terms like we do in medicine that are really foreign to folks who aren't in the field and weren't inculcated in this culture. And when we're introducing people to communications courses, it almost tells them, you know what, you need to talk differently as a doctor. And I did this myself. I took these communications courses and then wound up talking to my parents on the phone, and they actually stopped me and said, why are you using these terms? It's us, it's your parents. Why don't you speak to us like you always did? So I switched back and then started to try to relate to my patients on their level and talk to them the way I would my own family. I wonder if we should be introducing communications courses almost after the fact, almost after medical school and training, to re-educate people to say, wait a second, all this stuff, the brutality of training, the way that you felt as if you yourself were dehumanized and therefore were objectifying your own patients, that needs to stop. Let's switch it back now to what originally brought you in here.
That's a fascinating proposition. And I would venture to say that we need instructors like you teaching the medical students, because I think through your perspective, your the way you elicit the story and then and process it and your own humanism could be a model for our aspiring physicians. But I also recognize the importance of taking them back after the training process and reminding them, hey, I know you went through this arduous, grueling 3 years, 4 years, however long it took, but here is really what it's still all about. And I think that is what you're telling us right now.
I think that's exactly right. And also, I think we can apply to research, to how we approach the good scientific questions to ask.
Now, I do plan on getting to the science, because after all, you are a world-renowned leukemia specialist. But let me ask you, we are taught to be somewhat dispassionate in our approach to caring for patients, in part for self-preservation, because if you get so emotionally attached to the patient who is dying from whatever condition or that you cannot help, a piece of you also dies with you. What's your view about this, and what should be our position in terms of self-preservation, wellness, and so forth?
Well, I can only imagine what it's like from your perspective. You're a world-renowned pediatric surgeon, right? Even I can't treat kids. I think that's my line in the sand. I could never cross over to treating kids who are sick, because for me, I think I would get too emotionally invested and I would go into a spiral. So I'd love to hear how you do this as well. I would position this as, instead of saying that we're distancing ourselves or putting emotional distance from our patients, I think we're compartmentalizing. So when I'm in the room with my patients, I'm all in with them, right? And we have incredible conversations. I've seen more photos of kids and grandkids and family vacations. And I really try to learn something about my patient's perspective. And I think that in itself is a real privilege that we have. We get to actually go in there and learn about somebody else's life. There aren't a lot of professions where you get to do that. But I also, when I leave that room, my kids have actually told me they don't want to hear what happens at my work, which is interesting, right? That's the ultimate truth test, because your kids are going to tell you the truth.
That's right.
And I have, there have been times before when I come home, my kids said, oh, how was work today? I said, oh, it was a really, really tough day, because I had to tell somebody their leukemia was back. And they actually point blank said to me, we don't want to hear it. That's your job. And we don't want to hear the hard parts about your job, particularly when it involves other people who are suffering. So I think the way that I approach it is I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing that and separating out where I'm all in for my family and where I'm all in for my patients. And I wonder, as you know, there's so much discussion about burnout, Dean Ford. I wonder if it's maybe that's something else we should be teaching. I think people will argue about whether you can ever truly have a good work-life balance. But I do think we can be good about compartmentalizing what we do at work and what we do at home.
Natalie, I think you have hit on the crux of the matter. And it's partly the challenge of coping with the challenges that we face at work. We need to be able to decompress, to share some of those burdens and to have a cathartic moment. But yet, at the same time, recognizing that the individuals that form the nexus of your support may not be willing to engage at that level. And hence, you're forced to retreat and yet continue to give. So that creates some tension in and of itself. Because as parents, as spouses, and we have to meet the needs of our families, but at the same time, there is the individual struggle that needs to be addressed. And I've been wrestling with it my whole life, as you said. And it's just this notion of balance is just something that you learn to define and live with, and it's individualized.
Is there something that you do to separate that, to decompress? If you're, I mean, you have, I will say it again, I can't imagine how you do what you do with operating on kids and then working with their parents and sometimes working through very difficult health crises. How do you separate that from when you're at work and when you come home?
I've been fortunate to, in the sense that my wife has been a willing participant. She would listen. Although they're like your children, there are times as well, I've had enough. but when I've had some really challenging cases, like a baby dying in the operating room, for instance, or one that we worked on for days, months, and so forth, and that patient ends up losing the battle, whether it's a cancer or other illness, she's far more receptive. And one of the things that helped me early on in my career was my family just never had any idea about what it is that I do. I mean, they know I'm this doctor, I go take care of kids and this and that. And the first time was when I was at a Sesame Street, on ice, whatever, Disney on ice. Yeah, so we were in Pittsburgh, and so the family was with me, and then this lady came to me and with a little child who was just about the age of my daughter, and said, Dr. Ford, and then she told my wife, wow, your husband saved my child, and this is my child here. It that really began to change everything for the family. Maybe his idea of trying to help people, and it does make a difference. So that was good. And then another mother decided to get my wife's number and call the house to express her gratitude for sharing her husband with the rest of the world, because Yeah, I was able to help that child who had biliary atresia. So that really, because you know, they had told her the child was going to require a liver transplant, it was not going to do well, yeah. Die, so so forth. And well, you know, fortunately, the kid did extremely well. And so she was very grateful, but she wanted to express her gratitude directly to my wife. So, I think that helped. That helped because then people begin to understand at home some of the challenges that we face, but also the difference that we're making in other people's lives and why it's also important. So that gave me comfort. And then they became very good friends. They joined the same book club and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, and that, I think, was a game changer in terms of bringing to life the importance of the work that we are doing as physicians dealing with kids, whether it's cancer in my case and other lethal congenital anomalies, or in your case, really hematologic malignancies. So,
those are amazing stories. They really are, and it's funny how it's a turning point with your family as well. It's something that's random where they see what your role is, almost how you're part of this web of a community.
Yeah, I mean, it's both a privilege, but, you know, also a burden that we have to carry, right? So privilege to be in that position to be able to be impactful, to bring hope to other individuals. And at the same time, while it may take a toll on our personal lives and relationships and so forth, it also opens the door for them to have a better and deeper appreciation for your own humanity. And so overall, I think it's been good. Yes, you know, I'm sure you've confronted some of the challenges of having to miss some of the ballet recitals or soccer practice and so on and so forth. Because you're caught up in you know, taking care of a particular patient. But in the end, I think it's all been extremely powerful.
It has. And I will, so I get my one little moment to brag a little bit. My daughter is a sophomore at the U, who's a biomedical engineer and wants to go to medical school. So, it's a true point of pride and pleasure, I think, when one of your own kids decides, I have seen what you've done, and I've seen this life that you've created, and this is something that I want to do also.
Before we switch to the science, and we will make sure we handle the science in the second part of our podcast, tell us, as a cancer specialist, as a physician, as a storyteller, what brings you the greatest sense of satisfaction? What is the most gratifying aspect of your position?
I don't know if this happens to you, but when I'm at a dinner party or some social function and somebody asks me what I do and I say, well, I specialize in treating people with leukemia, that literally the music at the party grinds to a halt and somebody drops a glass and you hear it breaking, right? It's a non-starter for people. And the reaction that I usually get is, well, how can you do that? And there's a dirty little secret about being a hematologist oncologist, and that is that most of the time we're not telling somebody they have cancer. Someone else is telling them they have cancer. And then that person comes to us, and we're the person to say, okay, let's put this in a framework. Let's set expectations and establish goals, and let's treat this thing. And sometimes let's cure this thing. So to me, there's something incredibly satisfying. I keep talking about my patient's journey. There's something incredibly satisfying about starting that journey with somebody, providing appropriate amounts of hope. There is always some hope in what we're doing. And then sometimes that journey ends with cure, which is an incredible moment. It's an incredible moment when we're 5 years after a diagnosis, and I say to somebody, I really don't need to follow you anymore. You're probably cured. There is also an incredible amount of satisfaction in going on that journey with somebody, and let's say it's a particularly terrible leukemia to treat, and that leukemia does not go away with chemotherapy after chemotherapy, to then also work with a person on his or her goals and say, okay, what do you want to accomplish? Like, let's try to figure this out practically. And sometimes what that person wants to accomplish is making it to a grandchild's birth or a grandchild's college graduation, and we get there. And my patients always bring back the photos with them. I keep going back to these photos. There's one patient I had who was a grandfather, but his daughter had had drug addiction problems. So he took care of his granddaughter and he got her through high school and through college. And then he was diagnosed with lung cancer. And if that weren't bad enough, he was also diagnosed with leukemia. And I said to him, what are your goals? You have two life-threatening illnesses. What are your goals? And he said, my granddaughter, whom I raised, is getting married 3 months from now. I need to walk her down the aisle. And so we worked on it. We got his leukemia under control. Then his lung cancer spread to his brain. We got that under control. And I still have the photo of him walking with his granddaughter, locked arm in arm, down the aisle of the church. And it's not a head-on picture. He's looking off to the side to one of his buddies, right? And it's that look that you see in so many fathers of the bride where they're looking at their buddy and saying, I can't believe I'm going through this now also, just like you did. So it's this perfect capture of the moment. That's the sort of thing that really brings me the most amount of pride about what we do, to make sure our patients reach their goals.
So not only are you an amazing caregiver, listener, storyteller, but you're also a coach in that sense. Well, tell me, what are your goals? And we want to try to get that. And so that's remarkable. That's remarkable. Thank you so much for sharing this great story. And I think this is a good place for us to end this first portion of the podcast. So now we can focus in the second half on the actual cures that you have been able to accomplish and the treatments that you've utilized to bring some of those vexing problems into remission. So, Dr. Sekaris, it's been fantastic talking to you for this segment. I'm looking anxiously and excitedly about the second half, and I hope that our listeners are going to enjoy learning even more from you. So this has been the first portion of Inside Your Miami Medicine podcast with the incomparable Dr. Sekaris. So stay tuned for the next segment.